I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to Radio Times. The International Committee of the Red Cross says that the last remaining civilians and rebel fighters in eastern Aleppo are being evacuated amid heavy snow and freezing rain and could be completed by later today. And that could end the violent siege that has lasted for 4 years, giving the government of Bashar al-Assad a big victory in Syria's civil war that has killed and displaced hundreds of thousands of people. The scenes and stories from Aleppo underscore the suffering and the misery that residents have endured. We asked Liz Sly to join us. She's Washington Post, a Beirut bureau chief, and she's joining us by Skype. And Liz, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
Are we witnessing the beginning of the end of the revolution in Syria?
I think actually we witnessed the end of that quite a long time ago. Any hope that Assad was going to be toppled that the rebels may have had long ago passed, especially after the Russians intervened a year ago. It's now totally clear that they can't topple him. All that can be salvaged from this, from their point of view, is some sort of solution that gives them something to show for the years they've spent fighting.
Where are the people in East Aleppo? Where are they going? Where are they being evacuated to?
Well, they're mostly going to the province of Idlib in northwestern Syria, which is the last, one of the last areas that the rebels actually have almost full control over. And I think everybody's expecting that the battle will at some point shift there, although all eyes are on the diplomacy at the moment between Russia and Turkey. And because that province borders Turkey, Turkey does have quite a lot of influence over it. So I think it's going to become the focus of either a big new battle or some kind of settlement.
I mentioned, and it's hard not to think about and worry about the level of suffering and misery that we saw either through photographs or video or people posting online, what they have endured in East Aleppo.
Yes, it's been, I mean, it's been incredibly miserable. The siege has actually only been on for about 4 or 5 months now. For most of the past 4 years, there's been a giant battle raging for control over Aleppo, with the rebels controlling about half and the government controlling about half. But especially over the past year, the government has rapidly regained ground. And in these last few weeks, the rebels only controlled a few blocks of territory, basically. And thousands of people were crammed in there without food. It's freezing cold, as you said. Temperatures are sub-zero at night. There's very little in the way of fuel or heating, electricity to keep them warm. And it really could have been a terrible humanitarian catastrophe if the Russians and Turks hadn't negotiated this deal.
Well, and we heard about targeting hospitals and aid convoys. Are the Russians and the Syrian government, are they responsible for most of this misery?
Well, I mean, yes, if you look at what's happened to Aleppo, I mean, there's a big trend these days to say that what you're hearing in the media about the suffering in Aleppo and the damage and the bombardments and everything isn't true. But you can see from the journalists who've been into those areas in the past couple of weeks or so, and even on the government's own media, how incredibly damaged and devastated it was. Now, people were living in those buildings. They were people's homes, neighborhoods, and they were crowded. It was a very densely packed area. Somebody was suffering while all that bombardment was going on. People were getting killed. People were getting injured. And as you said, the hospitals were actually targeted. They were being put out of operation on a daily basis. That would come back up. They'd get knocked down again. It's really been an incredible humanitarian tragedy that's unfolded there.
And what does it look like in Western Aleppo?
Well, Western Aleppo is hardly touched. The rebels did fire mortars there and people did die, but the casualty rate isn't nearly as high as it's been in eastern Aleppo, where there were airstrikes every day, many airstrikes every day. And life goes on as normal there. There are bars and restaurants and cinemas and shops. And it's a real tale of two cities.
I mean, that is really surreal to think that people are going to the movies and going out to dinner in Western Aleppo and barely surviving in Eastern Aleppo.
Well, now Eastern Aleppo barely exists. I mean, it's people are going back to their very badly damaged homes, but it's going to be a very long time before that part of the city is functioning properly again. And you have thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of refugees from Aleppo living in Turkey, living crowded into the countryside of rebel-held areas, and people in Europe, of course, who've made their way there. And whether any of them will ever be able to go home is really in doubt.
Liz, when we hear about the rebels, plural, what are we talking about? And just how much have the rebels been fighting each other?
Well, the rebels have been fighting each other. They do it from time to time. They have a tendency to do it every time there's a critical moment and they need to band together to stave off a critical threat. There's a really good chance they will end up fighting each other. One of the reasons they have failed so dismally to come close to the goal of toppling the government is that they have been so bitterly divided. There is no unifying rebel force. There are hundreds of small groups. They're constantly squabbling with each other. And of course, as we know, some of them are Islamic extremist groups, such as the Al-Qaeda affiliates. Some are more Salafi, not quite Al-Qaeda. But yeah, the injection of the Islamic extremist element into the rebellion is another big reason why it has failed.
And that includes ISIS, yes?
Well, no, because ISIS is not with the rebellion. ISIS is against the rebellion, and the rebellion is against ISIS. And one of the things the rebels did do, one of the moments when they actually did join together, was in the January, February of 2014, when they rose up and kicked ISIS out of the province of Idlib and out of Aleppo City and drove them into the eastern areas where the US is now attacking them. And they have a front line. The rebels have a front line with ISIS in the northern Aleppo countryside that they are fighting over, and the US is backing somewhat, a little bit, the rebels against ISIS there.
And the government opposes ISIS as well.
The government opposes ISIS as well. You've actually got a four-way war going on in Syria right now between rebels, the government, the Kurds in the northeast, and ISIS, and all of them are battling each other.
Earlier this week, the Russian ambassador to Turkey was murdered. The man who murdered him shouted, "Don't forget Aleppo, don't forget Syria." How much, Liz, do you think this will change whatever happens in the future, either the next couple of days or the next couple of months in Syria?
I'm not sure the assassination of the ambassador in the Russian ambassador in Turkey is going to have a huge impact overall. It's probably brought the Turks and the Russians closer together because they are moving together on ways to find a solution to Syria now that the American diplomacy has failed so badly. They are finding common ground. I think what it does show is that Turkey is at risk down the line for some form of instability and unhappiness from its own citizens and from the millions of Syrian refugees living there. If it does move to accommodate with Russia for a solution that perhaps keeps Assad in power, they could face a lot of domestic opposition to that from certain quarters.
Well, what happens next, do you think? And I realize there are many moving parts here. It's hard to anticipate what is going to happen next. But Liz, as you look at all the players and all that's at play and at issue, where do you think this war goes next?
Well, all eyes are on Moscow, where Putin has said he does want to end the war. He seems actually to be quite genuine in looking for a settlement. The Turks, the Russians, and the Iranians are holding talks in Moscow, or have been holding talks in Moscow, to try and find a solution between them. It looks like they...
Oh, I think we just lost our guest. Unfortunately, Liz Sly, Washington Post bureau chief, joining us by Skype from Beirut. And we've been talking about the latest news out of Syria, the fact that most of eastern Aleppo has been evacuated. The final residents and even rebel fighters in Aleppo looks like they are being evacuated from the city. This is from the International Committee of the Red Cross reporting this morning. Well, with us and sitting across from me is Samer Aboud. He's a professor at Arcadia University, author of the book Syria. And he's been listening in as I've been talking with Liz. And Samer, always nice to have you back with us on Radio Times. You have been with us many times at this point talking about Syria. I'm curious about what you see about the fall of Aleppo or certainly the Assad and Russian military able to take Aleppo.
Thank you for having me again.
You're welcome.
Aleppo, in the long story that will be the Syrian conflict, will certainly be a major turning point. I think that in the first few years, and Liz had alluded to this, but up until the Russian intervention in September 2015, I think one of the central questions we used to ask is, why is the situation at a stalemate? Why do the front lines not move as quickly as we would expect in a country that was so heavily militarized and with so many groups fighting each other? And what happens when the Russian intervention begins in September 2015 is that the stalemate begins to crack. Mm. It starts in the south. They cut off rebel supply routes in the south, diminishing their capacities and their ability to conduct violence and also to reap the benefits of the war economy. And then slowly the intervention starts moving, and it culminates in Aleppo. As Liz alluded to, there's also Idlib remains a rebel stronghold, but Aleppo has political significance, of course. It has military significance, and most importantly, material significance as a supply route, as the major supply route for all the rebels. So taking Aleppo, taking the supply routes, effectively cuts off the ability of the rebel groups to reproduce themselves.
Is this the beginning of the end of the revolution? And I should say this started almost, 6 years ago, protests on the street.
Yes.
And here we are talking about really the destruction of half of a city.
Yes. Unfortunately, I have to agree with Liz on this, that the revolution probably died a long time ago.
Really?
And I say that because the main political question that I've been asking myself as somebody who cares deeply about the country and who has studied in the country and conducted research is what the possibilities for progressive political change are in Syria in the context of an uprising. And I think that as time went on, those possibilities diminished. And they diminished significantly after 2013 when a stalemate took root in Aleppo. And 2013 is also significant because it's when we have the kind of rapid introduction of violent Islamist Salafi jihadists into the Syrian conflict. And at that point, the rebel landscape begins to fracture. The politics of the uprising begin to fracture.
Were people turning on each other?
Yes, absolutely. And I think that what we see is a slow bleeding of the progressive capacities or the revolutionary capacities of Syrians who had organized themselves into local councils, had organized themselves into various fighting units, and who were, you know, from my perspective here, committed to revolutionary change. And I think that many of these people have suffered the fate of so many other Syrians, which is death, imprisonment, exile, bewilderment, a loss of hope. And I think that those possibilities are even lower now, especially when we consider who the main fighting groups were.
Well, I want to pick up on that, but first, a very short break. That's Samer Aboud. He's Associate Professor of History and International Studies at Arcadia University, just outside of Philadelphia, author of a book called Syria, Andrew Tabler Waiting in the Wings, and we are talking about the civil war in Syria, the evacuations from Aleppo, and U.S. foreign policy, and the future in that region of the world. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. It looks like the fall of Aleppo was a major victory for President Bashar al-Assad of Syria, marking a turning point in the almost six-year civil war that has killed and displaced hundreds of thousands of Syrians. And again, with us in our Philadelphia studio, Samer Aboud from Arcadia University, author of a book called Syria. And joining us by Skype is Andrew Tabler. He's the Martin J. Gross Fellow in the Program on Arab Politics at the Washington Institute. He wrote a book called In the Lion's Den, an eyewitness account of Washington's battle with Syria. Andrew Tabler, nice to have you with us on Radio Time.
Pleasure to be with you.
Andrew, I was just talking both with Liz Sly from the Washington Post, who's in Beirut, and also with Samer Aboud, and I know you two have been together with us on Radio Times, about the fall, the defeat, the victory, depending, I guess, on which side you're on, in East Aleppo. What do you make of this turning point?
Totally expected. This has actually been going on for months. The regime with Russian and Hezbollah and Iranian-backed group support had surrounded the city since the summer and was squeezing it. It's a tactic that's been used by the regime going back years. It's been quite effective. It's slow. It takes a while. But it allows the regime, with its limited manpower to and Russian support, to squeeze and starve areas. And we had, as a result, the fall of Syria's largest city. So all of this was in the cards. I'm not sure why many people are surprised by it. I do appreciate, though, that people are surprised by the horrific situation and the conditions and the situation that people found themselves in. I think this is going to be the, this is unfortunately one of many way stations on the road to this humanitarian disaster that we've all been witnessing and will continue to witness for the foreseeable future, I'm afraid.
Andrew, what did the Syrian government, what did they win by essentially winning in Aleppo? And I have to say, I was thinking in preparation for the show today, this comes from the Vietnam War about destroying the village to save it. And I wonder whether we can apply that to Aleppo.
That's a really good question. So if you look at the regime controls around a third of Syrian territory, a little bit more than that. And we're talking about here in rough terms. Over the last year, by at least one colleague's estimates, and there are a number, the regime's only gained back about between 2% and 4% of Syrian territory. But it was very good real estate, and it allowed. They had a specific operation targeting cutting off of the supply lines from Turkey to Aleppo first, then surrounding the city and carrying out, and then leading to its collapse. So I think that we're in a situation where, and this is an unfortunate thing, and I think some of your previous guests had mentioned this, at least what I had heard, we're in a situation where the humanitarian disaster in Syria is not just the fact that the rebels are losing the war, but it's that you have so many people outside of their homes, and you have the strengthening of the extremist groups among the opposition, who have stayed with the opposition and respected and supported their goal to oust Assad. So these two dangerous streams that came out of this horrific humanitarian situation do pose a strategic threat to neighboring countries and to the West. And dealing with it is going to be very difficult in the months and the years ahead.
Summer, one of the things that you have been writing about, specifically about Syria, is that it's not a binary fight. It's not this group versus that group. And Liz was telling us a little bit about all the – you've got ISIS, you've got the Kurds, you've got rebels, some of whom are fighting the Syrian government, some of whom are fighting each other. And, of course, then you've got the militias, you've got the Syrian government, you've got the Russians. I mean, obviously a stew of complications.
Yes. I think we need to reject the temptation to flatten the regime and the rebels. Andrew had alluded to the government, had alluded to Hezbollah and Iranian-backed militias. Liz had also alluded to the same thing. I think we need to go even deeper than that. When we consider the dozens of regional militias, of Syrian militias, of groups like the National Defense Forces that are Syrian, that are institutionalized and have a relationship with the regime, but are actually an alternative power center, what role did they play in the fall of Aleppo, if we want to call it a fall for now?
Right.
And I think we need to apply the same standards to the rebels. We have to reject the flattening of them. We have to reject the reduction of rebels to simply Islamists as well. There is no cohesion on either side. There is no centralized command. What we do know is that there are multiple groups from the outside that are supporting militias on either side, whether it's the Russians and the Iranians, or whether it's the Turks, Saudis, and Qataris, and the Americans for that matter. And so there are groups on the outside that are supporting different segments of the militarized groups. There is no cohesion among them. I think that's why we've had this kind of proliferation of violence, with a kind of war without winners. You know, I think Kissinger once used that term, and I think that's why we've had something like that in Syria, is precisely because there isn't any cohesion to these categories of regime or rebels.
Andrew, let me go back to you, and Summer, I'd like to hear from you as well. The Obama administration has been criticized by some for not doing more, for not intervening earlier, for not being more aggressive. Based on what Summer just described there, Andrew Tabler, what do you think, I guess with the advantage of 2020, could the Obama administration have done something to prevent what we're talking about today?
You know, it's funny. I've been getting this question for the past 2 weeks repeatedly, almost every day. And the answer is, of course, they could have. There were several junctures along the way that the U.S. could have intervened to shape and to help contain the crisis. We couldn't have solved it. I think it would be very difficult, but we could have shaped it. One was the summer of 2012 when the U.S. decided not to arm the moderate Syrian opposition. And then at the same time, ironically, President Obama drew a red line on the use of chemical agents in Syria. So unusual move. Then when that by the spring of 2013, we ended up doing the covert program anyway because our regional allies armed groups that we didn't like. And at the same time, the Assad regime began violating the chemical weapons red line, so much so that even the White House admitted it by the spring of 2013. Then there was an opportunity because to inform the American public of what action might be needed in Syria and why, how it could enforce this red line and how it could lead to a political outcome. President Obama didn't do any of that. He didn't prepare the American public. And so the attacks continued, and so much so and so egregiously that by the summer of 2013, with the Ghouta attack, they could no longer deny it. At that juncture, the red line could have been enforced, but they decided not to do so. And as we know, that led to the decrease in R stock among Syrians, and also sent a message around the world to lots of people that the United States under this administration was unwilling to use military force, even when it drew its own red line.
Do you see it that way, Sam? I'm sorry, Andrew. Yeah, do you see it that way?
Yeah, I agree with Andrew's analysis. I would add two things. The first is that we can't separate any of this from what the administration was doing in the rest of the region. So we can't separate it from Libya. We can't separate it from Egypt. We can't separate it. And I think it's a much longer conversation. So we have
Iraq.
Or Iraq, yes, absolutely. And I think the kind of parallel to that is that this administration had a particular view of what was happening in the region. Syria may or may not have fit within that view and provided sort of problems and complications for the administration. That's number one. The second thing that I would add to that, and perhaps Andrew was going here with this, is that when the political opposition, the Syrian political opposition, was for all intents and purposes, quite illegitimate in the eyes of many Syrians and in the eyes of the international community. And one of the things that they had staked their legitimacy on was in fostering more intervention from the outside, in getting the U.S. and getting others to intervene on behalf of the armed rebels on the inside. The armed rebels were becoming increasingly dependent on foreign intervention to break the stalemate. And I think that when the administration threw up its hands and says, okay, we're not intervening, I think that the green light Andrew spoke about was, I mean, the rebels were also given a red light in the sense that their military strategy and the political opposition, their military strategy was to affect intervention. When that was taken off the table, they were thrown into disarray. They had no other options, and they're still to this day advocating for an intervention that's never going to happen.
Do you think the president, though, could have convinced the American people after a war in Iraq, after the war in Afghanistan, which is still going on, that it was time to be more interventionist in Syria?
Yeah. Well, one of the things that has always puzzled me is that we have, I mean, in the United States, we have been intervening. The administration has been intervening for 2 years in Syria, fighting ISIS. The administration has been intervening
Absolutely.
In all sorts of other ways. And I'm not, I want to say that kind of parenthetically, I'm not an advocate of intervention. But if the case was going to be made, then they're already doing it. And why not, why not extend it if that's the policy? Why not extend the logic, extend the resources, extend the political will? And I think it brings us to the question of what was the political will of this administration and also what kind of outcome was it trying to affect? I mean, these kind of half solutions, half answers to everything contributed to these outcomes.
Andrew, you said exactly.
No, I totally agree. I mean, in the end, we ended up intervening in Syria, except without a political plan. we got the politics totally wrong because we missed all these junctures. And look, you know, in looking back on this, I realized a lot of these were tough calls. And I'm not somebody who was an opponent of the president. I voted for him. But, you know, if you look back on all this, and especially over the last year, the president has, after all this has happened, after all this has even happened with ISIS, which is where I was going with my last comments, in the end, the president then goes out and gives interviews about how the choices in Syria, particularly the red line, were his moment of liberation. Liberation from what? I don't understand. I mean, really, it seems like a personal matter. And this is on the merits, the fact is that our Syria policy by this administration directly and indirectly led to this situation. Right? And to suggest that everyone who had advocated for intervention was somehow a warmonger and so on, this is no one wanted boots on the ground in Syria. The intervention over the red line was only using missile strikes and other kinds of offset assets. So it is strange to me the degree to which the administration continues to say that this is the best we could have done. I don't think that holds water given the situation that we're in now.
Well, let me play U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Samantha Power. She was speaking actually last week, December 13th, at a U.N. Security Council emergency briefing about the responsibility the Syrian government, Russia, and Iran bear for the atrocities in Aleppo. Let's give it a listen.
To the Assad regime, Russia, and Iran, your forces and proxies are carrying out these crimes. Your barrel bombs and mortars and airstrikes have allowed the militia in Aleppo to encircle tens of thousands of civilians in your ever-tightening noose. It is your noose. Three member states of the UN contributing to a noose around civilians. It should shame you. Instead, by all appearances, it is emboldening you. You are plotting your next assault. Are you truly incapable of shame? Is there literally nothing that can shame you?
Summer, does the U.S. bear some shame?
Absolutely. Of course. We're talking about the U.S.'s military role, potential military role. We're not talking about the political role it could have played, the diplomatic role it could have played, or the humanitarian role it could have played. We also need to consider what our allies have done and how they've contributed to, you know, I should say parenthetically, I don't want to draw a moral, political, or military equivalency between the horrors of what the regime and its allies have done and what the rebels have done. There is no equivalency. There is no parallel kind of sustained barrel bombing of loyalist areas. So with that said, we're also implicated, and I don't think that we can avoid that responsibility. We're implicated because of the ways in which we intervened. We're implicated in the ways in which we did not marshal political resources, diplomatic resources to end this conflict. We're implicated in the ways in which we've thrown our hands up and said, well, they're going to bomb the convoy, so why not? I have not seen in my lifetime a cause that demanded courage more than this one in terms of the humanitarian response, and we haven't seen any courage from this administration on the humanitarian level or on the political level. And I think that we see it also on the military front as well. So I think that we are implicated, and we're also implicated in the region. And I will leave it at that.
Andrew, is it too late for the U.S. to do any of the things that you and Summer have been talking about?
No, but our options are limited in the sense that, look, Russia intervened. Iran sent proxies to back up the Assad regime. They're going to hold on to at least large swaths of the country. But because of their limited manpower, they are 2/3 of the country is outside of their control. So you still have the option of, for example, safe zones, which even Donald Trump has talked about in recent speeches. So there's that. There's strikes against extremists, which will continue. And there's also possible strikes against the Assad regime, although I don't think that's likely given the penchant for the indications that the Trump administration would like to explore diplomatic options with the Russians. So there's still options. And we'll have to see if this president prefers action over interaction.
I wonder, Andrew, whether – and this is, I guess, getting into the head of the president and his administration – whether with the intervention of Russia, they were basically saying to Russia and to Putin, well, good luck with this. You know, you're going to get dragged into the quagmire of the Middle East as we have been. You're not going to do any better than we will.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Yet another lecture. So, look, the fact is the Russians have intervened in Syria with they run their operations in Syria out of their training budget. They're under really strict international sanctions, and they're still able to affect an outcome militarily and politically with very little invested. I think we were just outplayed here, and I think the results speak for themselves. And I think that's one of the things that motivates President-elect Trump. And he looks at this situation and says, okay, you know, like the trajectory we're on didn't work. Maybe we need to go and see what's possible with the Russians. But, you know, walking that line is going to be difficult, I think, for anyone, because the Russians have different interests in Syria than we do. And we'll have to see if the dynamic of this administration holds true in the next.
Well, let's take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Much more to talk about. That's Andrew Tabler. He's the Martin J. Gross Fellow in the Program of Arab Politics at the Washington Institute. Wrote a book called In the Lion's Den, an eyewitness account of Washington's battle with Syria. Also with us, here in our Philadelphia studio, Samer Aboud. He's Associate Professor of History and International Studies at Arcadia University. That's just outside of Philadelphia. And he's the author of a book called Syria. And we are talking about Syria, the crisis in Aleppo, the fact that hundreds of thousands of Syrians have been killed or displaced. Talking about the role that the United States could have played or could still play, 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join the conversation. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. It looks like Aleppo is basically under government control. This would be for the first time since rebels took control of the eastern parts of the city back in 2012. And recapturing this city, the whole city, looks like a victory for Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. 1-888-477-9499. I was reading to Samer here a comment from Vladimir. Let me read it on the air. Vladimir says, there have been reports from Westerners who have recently visited Aleppo that contradicts much of the narrative of Western media. Can you respond to that?
Yes, this is unfortunately one of the many wars that's happening in the cyber world over Syria, which, you know, at the end of the day may be silly when there's so much human suffering happening. I believe one of the things Vladimir might be referring to is this case of a Canadian journalist who had gone to Syria and had come back and had basically said everything you know about Syria is a lie. And there's this narrative that's emerging among many English-speaking journalists who've now gone into Syria, not necessarily Aleppo, but into Damascus and other parts of the country, and are coming back and saying, look, there's another story here. And I don't entirely disagree with that. What I disagree with is the political implication of supporting the regime and its allies and saying, look, you know, it's not really that bad. It's a war and bad things happen in wars. I do not personally or politically see an inconsistency in saying there is humanitarian suffering and there is a huge segment of the population that supports the regime, or that there are people who have lived under these conditions of fear and insecurity for 5 years and want nothing but stability, and they don't care who brings it to them. I don't see those points as being inconsistent with each other. Unfortunately, on the many debates around Syria today, people have taken these very hardened positions where to say that there have been barrel bombs dropped on Aleppo is to also say that the rebels are good and humane and wonderful progressive people. That's not the case. We can also criticize the political and ideological composition of the rebel groups while also saying that what is happening in eastern Aleppo is horrific and awful. And I think that this is part of the binary trap, right, that many of us are falling into.
But Russia, as we know, has been, you know, bombing civilian sites and doing things that I think would violate humanitarian laws or even the laws of war. If the U.S. were more militarily engaged, would we have to do something like that in order to have some kind of parity in Syria? Well, let me put that to you.
That's a good question.
What would it take? Yeah. What does it take to win a war like this, I guess? And does it mean you have to get down and dirty?
I want to claim military ignorance, I suppose, before I give my answer. Of course, wars are awful things. Of course, awful things happen to good people in conflicts, and many of the people making these decisions are totally immune from their consequences. In the Syrian case, I suppose some diminishing of the regime's capacity. You know, I know many people have advocated for no-fly zones, which I don't necessarily support because I think that it's a slippery slope. So I'm not advocating it. I'm suggesting what some of the military options might have been. I know that there have been calls to bomb runways so that airplanes and helicopters can't take off. And that certainly would have mitigated the assault on these areas and would have maybe alleviated some of the suffering. But I'm sure that they would have found other ways to intervene. We can't underestimate how many thousands of militiamen are running around Syria now without any reference to the law, any kind of political idea. And that is also wreaking havoc on people. One of the things that we don't talk a lot about in the West are the sieges that rebels have imposed on what are commonly called loyalist towns in Fua, Kufraya, these areas. Again, there is no equivalency. The point is that Syrians are suffering from all sides. They're suffering from militiamen on the ground. They're suffering from horrible things, from aerial assaults. And how a military solution could have stopped that at this point or could have slowed it down is above my pay grade, I think.
I believe we have Andrew Tabler back on Skype. Andrew, are you with us?
I am. I'm on phone.
You're on phone now. Okay, very good. Good old phone system. What can I tell you? One of the things that I know you've written about and you mentioned earlier in the interview about the manpower shortages among the military associated with President Bashar al-Assad. Just how serious is that? And does that limit, I guess, what his government can do?
Yes. So I'm sure you have a lot of veterans listening. So the estimates of regime deployable manpower that can go outside of frontline areas, take and hold areas, is around 20 to 25,000 in the entire country.
Wow.
So, you know, I'm not saying the Assad regime has only that number of troops, but in order to go on the offensive and take new areas, you know, we have these kind of numbers. But let's everything in the Syrian war is fuzzy. Let's double it. Let's make it 40,000. Even that. How can you retake and hold two-thirds of Syrian territory with 40,000 people, 40,000 men? You can't do it, right? It's very difficult. So that is a calculus that with an Assad-based solution, which some advocate, and not addressing the divisions in the country, would mean that the timeline for Assad retaking his territory could well be in years, not months. I think it probably is in years, unless we are tolerant of or okay with Iran importing a lot more Shia militia into Syria to shoot the way out of this with the regime. And I just don't think politically that's something that will work in the Middle East. So I think instead we'd be better off going towards a real political solution. And I think that's what Turkey's now exploring with the Russians and the Iranians. And unfortunately, the U.S. is out of the room. So an early opportunity or early effort by the Trump administration will hopefully be to get us back in the room so that we can help affect the situation.
And do you think the fact that Donald Trump seems to be more overtly friendly to Russia and Putin, do you think, Andrew Tabler, that would help with negotiations?
It could. It really just depends on what we agree on and we don't agree on. In Syria, we with the Russians, we don't agree on two things. One is what is a moderate group and what is not a moderate group. We have disagreements on that. But most importantly with the Russians, we just have a fundamental disagreement, and I think they would say this as well, on what stability means. For them, stability is order. And for us, stability is some sort of political environment that creates institutions that provide long-term order, right? And so we're coming at it from different angles. Their military intervention focuses much more on hitting the opposition groups on a broader spectrum than we have been comfortable with. We'll have to see if President-elect Trump feels the same way.
Let me get Anthony from San Francisco to join our conversation. Hi, Anthony. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, Marty, and good morning to you guys. Thanks for taking my call.
You're
this
welcome.
Morning. You know, I just want to say, before I make my comment on Syria, I don't think Vladimir Putin is stupid enough to create another war with the nuclear superpower, yet I think the United States is stupid enough to start a war with a nuclear superpower, which would end all wars.
Wait, Anthony, I got to stop you there. You're saying that the United States is willing to start a nuclear war.
No, it seems like that. Because of what the United States has done in Iraq previously, in Afghanistan previously, Vietnam, Korea, the Russians are trying to prevent another catastrophe that the United States has created around the world and has done since the dawn of time. What we're seeing is just a repeat of the playbook of Iraq. And I don't understand why.
How is Russia preventing a catastrophe?
Well, I mean, trying another regime change. I mean, Iraq, there's no stability in Iraq right now. Are you really serious? Like, we never helped.
Well, we're talking about Syria, Anthony.
But I understand that. But the precedent is, if we look at previously what the United States has done around the world in other foreign affairs, you know, it's dropping bombs doesn't create peace. What we're doing is we're uprooting a government that, unfortunately, yes, he might have killed a few thousand people, but he kept the peace. Saddam kept the peace. Gaddafi kept the peace. We put those people in power. The United States did. So what we're realizing and what we're seeing is that Assad is not following the rules anymore. He doesn't want the pipeline built through his country that the Saudis want. And this is what's happening right now. This is geopolitics, and we need to discuss geopolitics and Henry Kissinger and what Zygmunt Brzezinski say.
Well, hold on. Let me just jump in here because I want to keep it focused on Syria. Of course, it's all interconnected here, but I want to give Andrew Taylor just a chance to respond to what Anthony said. What do you think, Andrew?
I think the Russians do have their own concerns. I don't think, though, that, you know, U.S. policy has never been regime change in Syria. In fact, if you look at what President Obama said, he never said that Assad had to go. He said he had to step aside, as did the rest of the Western countries, and even a number of other non-Western countries. So, but, you know, it does beg the question, what comes next?
Right.
Right. The fact is that Iraq and Syria are different in that Iraq was a war of choice. It had a lot of problems that went along with it. But Saddam was a problem long before that, invaded his neighbors. It's not just that he was incredibly brutal. In this case, Assad tried to shoot his way out of his uprising and lost two-thirds of his territory. We weren't responsible for that. We were responsible for managing it. So I think, though, that, you know, one solid criticism is that the U.S. should spend more time on looking at what is the alternative to these regimes, and once they find it politically, going for it if they decide that that regime should step aside. And we didn't plan that very well. And the Russians, not seeing an option, intervened the way they did in ways that we didn't like. We'll see, though, if it ends up being stable. I'm not sure it will be. We'll have to see if motion is really action here. And the war's not over, and we'll have to revisit this in the future and see where we are.
Well, and Anthony raises a point, which, Summer, if you look at Iraq without Saddam Hussein, you look at Libya without Gaddafi, mm-hmm. These strong men who used brutality in many ways to keep their countries together, mm. Without them, what happens to their country?
Good point. I think it's a valid point to bring up, but I would have two immediate responses. The first is, I don't think that we sitting in Philadelphia or San Francisco or anywhere in the West have the right to tell Arabs who to live under. What is stable and secure for us is horrifically unstable and insecure for many people in the region. That's not to say that there weren't people who were loyal to the regimes and believed in them for many reasons. The second thing that I would add is that we can't the removal of Saddam Hussein by itself was not what created the Iraqi tragedy. On the one hand, there are the decades of kind of rot that had happened to Iraqi institutions and to relations between people and different groups that had that kind of came to the surface. And we can't deny that. I mean, living under decades of authoritarian rule has really negative impacts on institutions and people's ability to kind of deliberate and things of that nature. The second point on that is the way in which the withdrawal was managed. We're talking here as if the world is a game of Risk, that we go in and we take people out and we put people in and we move weapons here and we move weapons there. This is traumatic for people. We bear the responsibility of millions of people's individual and collective traumas. And we can't ignore that. We can't ignore what the removal of somebody with, I mean, remember shock and awe?
Sure.
Remember how we watched it on television as if it was a video game. And the people were living that. If I know people here in the West who are losing sleep over watching the news, what were the experiences of Iraqis living there? If we look at a map of suicide bombings, car bombings in Baghdad since 2003, the map is entirely red, filled with bombs everywhere. Basically, every neighborhood in Baghdad has experienced some form of bombing, in addition to decades of sanctions, in addition to authoritarianism. How people react to the removal of a dictator in that context, I think Andrew used the language of management, and I think it wasn't managed, if to use that language. Iraq was managed horribly. I mean, look at CPA provision, whatever, law number one, get rid of all the Ba'athists, 2 million people with skills and the ability to run institutions, gone, on the street. I mean, where did your insurgency come from? Where did your opposition come from? Where did all of these come from? So I think we need to stop thinking that the Middle East is just another part of a risk of the game of Risk. It's not.
I would love to spend another hour talking about what you just talked about there, Summer. We only have about a minute, but Andrew, just picking up on what we have been talking about and what Summer said in particular there about perhaps U.S. ignorance, arrogance. I'm not sure what the word is about the Middle East, about, you know, are there lessons learned that we can apply going forward? 45 seconds. I'm sorry to do that to you, Andrew.
Sure. When I came back, when I lived about 15 years in the Middle East, and when I came back, I thought that politics or that Middle East policy was about what is happening on the physical plane of reality with an eye towards what can be. It's not. It's about what powerful people want and what they want, and then with an eye towards what is. And they cherry pick from this physical plane of reality. And the more we lurch back and forth politically, the more cherry picking goes on and the worse our Middle East policy gets.
Well, we're going to leave it there. Andrew Tabler, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
My pleasure.
And he's the Martin J. Gross Fellow in the Program on Arab Politics at the Washington Institute. His book is In the Lion's Den, an eyewitness account of Washington's battle with Syria. Samer Abood, thank you as always for joining us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. Associate Professor of History and International Studies at Arcadia University. His book is called Syria. And we began our conversation with Liz Sly, Washington Post, Beirut Bureau Chief, covering Syria, Lebanon, Iraq, and beyond. Good to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Thank you for joining us.